7th in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. Featured artists include A Special Evening with Saul Williams, April 5th at Woolly Mammoth Theater, Sunken Cages, Dragon Child, and Faraway Ghost at Millennium Stage, April 4th, Diggable Planets, Sun Ra Orchestra, and more at the Jazz and Blossoms Park Jam, April 7th, plus Poetry Slams, a hip-hop education conference, and free dance workshops all week. To learn more about all the events, visit WBLINC.org/WBLFest.
Seven humanitarian aid workers delivering food in Gaza are bombed to death by Israeli forces. Biden says he's outraged, but what will it take for him to call for a ceasefire? Jewish activist and author Sarah Schultz offers her perspective on the ongoing genocide in Gaza. And he fought fiercely in World War II, swearing to join the hunt for Adolf Hitler, to hack him to pieces and count the demons as they flew out of his wounds. But by the end of his life, Philip Berrigan had been nominated not once but twice for the Nobel Peace Prize. Good morning, good morning, and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Seven humanitarian aid workers traveling in a clearly marked vehicle and coordinating their movements with the Israeli military were nonetheless bombed to death yesterday in an Israeli airstrike in Gaza. The World Central Kitchen staff had just delivered 100 tons of food in Gaza. They're the biggest provider of humanitarian aid there, and now celebrity chef Jose Andres says his operation will pause its deliveries. Cyprus says its ships carrying more than 200 tons of food are turning back. And according to NBCNews.com, half the population of the Palestinian enclave is on the brink of famine. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu calls it a tragic case of our forces unintentionally hitting innocent people, but he says it happens in war, and he will do everything possible to prevent a reoccurrence. An investigation is pledged to get underway. One of the seven killed was a U.S. citizen with dual citizenship in Canada. President Biden says he's outraged and heartbroken and says Israel is not doing enough to protect aid workers. Meanwhile, thousands of Israelis have taken to the streets calling for early elections to oust Netanyahu. Sarah Schultz is an activist, an author, a Guggenheim Fellow, and one of the 18 Jewish elders who chained themselves to the fence in front of the White House during Hanukkah last year. Good morning, Sarah Schultz, and welcome to What's at Stake.
Good morning, it's Shulman. Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Shulman. Okay, I apologize for
that's
that.
Okay.
Biden is outraged and heartbroken over this, quote, unintentional bombing of the World Central Kitchen convoy. Does that represent any movement in his heretofore seemingly unwavering support for Israel, in your opinion?
None at all. It doesn't matter what he says as long as he continues to send billions of dollars to Israel, which they use for weapons, which of course they buy from American companies. It's a grotesque act of hypocrisy. And I just want to say that the demonstrations in Israel against Netanyahu have nothing to do with the mass murders of Palestinians. What they're protesting is his inaction in terms of freeing hostages. And it was interesting because yesterday there was violence by Israeli soldiers against Israeli demonstrators. This is new, and I think this is going to escalate, and we need to watch that.
So what were you hoping to achieve when you and the others chained yourselves to the fence in front of the White House? What specific actions were you calling for at that time?
I did the media for that event, so I did not actually chain myself, but I was there. Jews are, the majority of Jews in America are against this war. The only group of Jews that are supporting this are people over 65. So it's very important that Jews who oppose this war and want a ceasefire show ourselves. And we have been trying to do that. I'm a member of Jewish Voice for Peace. There are other groups like If Not Now, and people have been doing actions regularly, if not daily, getting arrested in mass at Grand Central Station in Washington, D.C. And it was very important to for JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace, to do an action in front of the White House to be sure that the world knows that Biden is not doing this for Jews. This is not about Jewish safety. This is about military interests, land rights, mineral interests. You know, and it's interesting, Columbia University banned Jewish Voice for Peace and Students for Justice in Palestine. So the fact that they banned a Jewish student organization shows you this is nothing about Jews, it's about Zionism.
So let me ask you, do you know who Michael Robb of Boulder, Colorado is?
No.
Okay, he's a 77-year-old former U.S. fighter pilot who participated in the pro-Palestinian protests last October, holding a sign that read, "Stand with Hamas, end Israel, free Palestine." Well, he was arrested and told that he may be committing a terror offense. Robb was sentenced to pay a $1,000 fine because, according to Judge Annabelle Pilling, he was guilty of displaying an article in such circumstances as to arouse reasonable suspicion that he was a member of or supporter of a proscribed organization. Hamas is a terrorist organization in the UK. Yesterday, Robb refused to pay the $1,000 fine. The judge gave him a week to pay in full or be held in contempt of court. Now, you have written about how allegiance to Palestine has become criminal in certain parts of the country. Can you expound on that, please? Yeah, and the world, yes.
Well, the murders and kidnappings that took place on October 7th did not just come out of thin air. And they've been contextualized that way. So the way that the U.S. media is portraying these events is that everything was fine, everything was great. And for some reason that we don't understand, this monstrous, violent entity appeared and murdered people. But actually, this came out of, this is the consequence of 75 years of dispossession, of mass incarceration, of murder, of home demolition, of every level of oppression that you can imagine. It's inevitable that it would produce some kind of violent resistance. And that's what occurred. So in order to understand the cycle of violence, we have to look at the source, which is the oppression. And Israel could end this cycle of violence in 1 second if they would stop the occupation and siege. If every person who lived on that land had equal rights, had passports, could live wherever they wanted, could go to whatever school they wanted, you know, but it's the trying to control and suppress another people that is what causes this cycle of violence.
And people that have spoken in favor of Palestine, Palestinians, have suffered considerable retaliation.
People have had their careers ruined. Recently, there's been a spate of firings for very little. I mean, David Velasco, who was the editor of Art Forum, Jasmine Hughes, who was a writer at the New York Times, both were fired because they signed a letter. This is not, you know, when you think about during the Vietnam War, when we all used to get Life magazine and you would open it and see photographs of murdered Vietnamese civilians running, terrorized. These people were not even showing what was actually happening. They joined others in signing a letter. I mean, many of the people who are being fired are not hardcore Palestine activists. They're just people who are horrified by these events. And the punitive nature of the opposition is very dramatic. I mean, we've seen professors being fired, journalists being fired, student groups being banned. And what's really at stake is they just don't want to let people say their views. That is what is being repressed, because there's a fake discourse in this country about Israel, which is the perpetrator in this case, but they're being presented as the victim. And anyone who counters that can be subjected to this punitive power. I mean, and Pulitzer Prize winning writer Viet Nguyen was canceled at the 92nd Street Y in New York City because he signed a letter. That's pretty dramatic.
Three Muslim anchors at MSNBC, they were relieved of their host duties as well. And you think in terms of MSNBC as one of the more, I wouldn't say progressive, but at least fairer.
That's
news
just
networks.
Marketing. MSNBC is to the Democratic Party what Fox is to the Republican Party. And they do not deviate from their Democratic Party policy.
So clearly a ceasefire would be the ideal solution for starters. But there's the issue of the billions of dollars in arms sales the U.S. is supplying Israel to conduct its genocide against the Palestinian people. Are there civil disobedience actions planned, to your knowledge, calling for the U.S. to suspend the transfer of arms, since the U.S. is the biggest supplier of arms to Israel? We're essentially providing them with the weapons to commit the genocide. What about targeting congressmen and women?
Okay, these types of actions have been going on daily and globally. I mean, there are millions of people have been in the streets opposing this war. The people of this world oppose this war. And the people power against the war is growing exponentially. It's the people at the top that keep it going. So there are actions in New York City every single day. There are actions all across the country. They do target. Schumer had many, many actions in front of his office and in front of his house. My congressman, who is a terrible negative force who supports Israel no matter what, Dan Goldman, has been had demonstrations targeted to him. And then there's also been support for people like Cori Bush, who started the ceasefire caucus with one person. And now there are many people in that caucus, including some Jewish congresspeople. So Cori Bush is endorsed by Jewish Voice for Peace, and If Not Now, so is Rashida Tlaib. I mean, people in the government who are working towards permanent ceasefire are receiving support from the Jewish community.
So the $18 billion that the U.S. is giving to Israel to supply them with weapons, that just continues. And it seems as though there's nothing, and all these demonstrations are taking place on a daily basis all around the world. And it's reported that 66% of Americans and 80% of Democrats support a ceasefire. But that doesn't seem to be swaying the Biden's administration's position. Why do you suppose that is?
I think it's just him. I mean, his staff did a demonstration calling for a ceasefire in front of the White House. His campaign staff issued a letter calling for a ceasefire. I think that he's just a relic from World War II. He hasn't figured it out, and he doesn't know how to get out of it. I don't know if he's even trying. I have no insight into his psychology, but he is the problem.
So you're saying that the staff is opposed, but Biden is entrenched and not moving.
I believe that, yes. And apparently Kamala Harris's speech, where she called for a ceasefire, was actually even more radical than that, but it was edited down or, quote, censored by the Biden staff. So who knows what's going on over there, but I think it's him.
So you mentioned this a little bit earlier, but you quoted an article as saying the U.S. is arming and funding this massacre of Palestinians, not for Jewish safety, but for its own interests. Articulate once again, what are the interests that you think they are attempting to protect here?
Well, Israel has always been a military outpost for the United States. We know that there's natural resources that people want. It's also a land grab. I mean, genocide is almost always connected to land grab. We know that people are trying, right-wing Jews are trying to buy up the Gaza properties already. Jared Kushner was talking about this, so that's what's involved. And I think Netanyahu just wants to kill every person in Gaza. I mean, not only are they killing people who are bringing food and we're not allowing food to come in, they have tried to destroy every hospital. They have succeeded at destroying every university and school in all of Gaza. I mean, this is all so deliberate, and they're just trying to kill everybody. That's what it looks like to me.
So the Biden administration's interests are, as you said, the military outpost. Now, what are the natural resources that
I'm not an expert on that, but I know that there's a land grab going on. I mean, Jared Kushner gave a speech at Harvard. I don't know why Harvard allowed him to speak there, but saying that there was great waterfront property in Gaza. You know, look ahead to Club Med Gaza as their future vision. They just want to kill everyone or push them into Egypt. And Egypt, by the way, is charging $8,000 a head for people to get across the Rafah gate, and people having to fundraise internationally to get their families across. It's unbelievable. The level of depravity.
Am I the only one that thinks Biden could lose this election over Palestine? I mean, 80% of Democrats support a ceasefire. Polls show that RFK Jr. is pulling votes from both Biden and Trump, but more so from Biden. RFK Jr. says Biden is more of a threat to democracy than Trump. So apparently it's not in the Biden administration interest to move the needle on position with Israel?
Well, yesterday in the New York primary, I voted blank. And many people are doing that. And in New York, it's not a swing state. But in some swing states, for example, Michigan, which has a very large Arab population, you cannot ask Arab people to vote for Biden. It's a ridiculous ask. So, you know, some of these swing states could be significantly impacted by people's absolute moral inability to vote for Biden.
Mm-hmm. And I know that, well, there was a letter that was disseminated provided to the Biden administration where about 500 individuals had actually signed on to that letter. Are you familiar with that letter? Is that one that you signed as well?
I think so. I mean, I have signed a lot of letters. Yes. And so have many other people. We're doing everything we can to be heard. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Some people are afraid, however, to sign the letters. They say that, they're afraid they'll lose their jobs as a result of that. Is there any evidence?
Right.
Is that a grounded fear? Is there any evidence that?
Yes,
they
that
could?
Is. There's much evidence. There's quite a few people. We were talking about some of them earlier in our conversation who've been fired. Certainly, it can affect promotion in academia. If you don't have tenure, it's very dangerous. You know, and some people are very brave and they're following their conscience. It's scary. In 2016, when I was a professor at the City University of New York, I was the faculty advisor to Students for Justice in Palestine, and I got charged with anti-Semitism, which is absurd. I had to go into a hearing with an attorney. The person who represented CUNY was the lawyer who defended Dominique Strauss-Kahn when he raped that African woman in a hotel. I mean, that's the level they had 14 pages of charges, all of which were fabricated, and 6 months later I was exonerated. But I'm Jewish. That's why I got I got through. If I was not Jewish, I could have been had my tenure questioned, because what they're trying to do is to say that criticizing Israel is a hate crime, because they're trying to equate criticizing Israel with saying anti-Semitic things. And if you are convicted of a hate crime of criticizing Israel, it can trip the moral turpitude clause of your tenure, for example. This is very, very dangerous stuff. Now, this was 8 years ago, but their machine is much stronger now.
Mm. And there is a debate as to whether criticizing Israel is anti-Semitic or whether that's anti-Zionism.
Absurd equation. This is a political situation and a moral and ethical situation, and people have to be free to come out against mass murder. It cannot be that opposing the murder of 30,000 people is hate speech. It's absurd.
So talk to us a little bit about the difference between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism.
Well, anti-Zionism means that you oppose the idea of Jewish supremacy and having a state in which people's rights are determined by their religions, having a state where people have different set of rights based on what religion they are. I mean, I think if you understand it that way, most Americans would oppose that because freedom of religion is very important to most Americans. But anti-Semitism is a old, old system of seeing Jews as a group, holding all Jews accountable for the actions of some, fantasies that all Jews are rich, that they have a conspiracy that runs the world. These types of things are ancient, and you know they're very much in place. And we see in the Christian right, the evangelical right, and the white supremacist right in the United States, we see a lot of anti-Jewish speech and feeling. But ironically, those people support Israel. So we're seeing that fascist entities that are domestic support the Israeli government.
Now, I kind of believe American Jews could force the administration to call for a ceasefire, but it would have to be all American Jews, not just the progressive ones, Jewish Voice for Peace. Do you think there's any chance there could be a dialogue between Jews that support Israel and progressive Jews that could lead to a middle ground agreement that could end this inhumane suffering that we're being forced to witness?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that I think the main force in America that supports the current Israeli government are Christian evangelicals, Christian Zionists. Mm-hmm. But yes, there are Jews who oppose these groups like AIPAC. Recently, a letter went out that was signed by some very moderate people opposing AIPAC, people who oppose the ADL, which I do. I think the ADL is a rogue organization. I don't understand why they're constantly on television. They have no legitimacy. And this has been going on forever. I mean, I talk to Zionists all the time. That's what our job is as Jews who oppose this war. But, you know, there's other entities besides Jews who are behind this war. If this was only because of Jews, this war would not be happening.
So, Sarah Schultz, what do you Shulman. Think is the next? I'm so sorry. Sarah Schulman, mm-hmm. What do you think the next action should be? If all the, people tying themselves to the, chaining themselves to the fence of the White House and holding vigils and protests across the world. What can be done?
Well, I think we're acting on as many levels as we possibly can. So we're seeing a credible amount of student activism. Students for Justice in Palestine is now the largest political student organization in the United States. Jewish Voice for Peace now has 90 chapters. I mean, these movements are growing. Campus organizing, people calling their congresspeople. If your representative is voting the wrong way, call them and tell them what you think. If you're the kind of person who's comfortable doing civil disobedience, there are actions every single day that you can be part of. Open letters, statements, and also the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement has had an incredible lift. A few days ago, the Harvard Law School student body voted to boycott Israel. Boycott, divestment, sanctions is a nonviolent strategy that Palestinians are asking us all to do. It's about boycotting any entity that is funded by the Israeli government. It's not about individuals. It's about state-funded organizations. And so there's
what are some of those organizations? Do you know them?
Oh yeah, it's like supporting. Like for example, if I had an invitation to go to an Israeli university, I would not go because all of the universities are funded by the government. There's an incredible book that just came out by Maya Wind called Towers of Iron and Steel about how the Israeli university system is used by, is an extension of the Israeli government in terms of what the apparatus of controlling Palestinian life. Artists who are not funded by the government, fine. It's not about being Israeli. It's about people who are extensions of the government through government funding. So companies that are funded by the government, et cetera.
What about the average American citizens? I heard that Starbucks perhaps is supporting Israel.
I'm not informed about that. It's possible. Okay. Yeah, I'm not informed.
I think there probably should be a list of organizations, companies, corporations that people can deliberately, if they so choose, to you know.
Well, people can go to the Jewish Voice for Peace website, and there's all kinds of toolkits, including very clear explanations about the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, and how to support that. But any person can call their congressperson and tell them how they feel.
A lot of good that's going to do. I kind of feel like they already know.
I kind of disagree with you, because as I said earlier, when Cori Bush started the ceasefire caucus, she was the only person in it. And, you know, public opinion has moved so much against this war that now there's quite a few people in it. So some of these people do move. Some of them don't, you know, but some of them do.
Mm-hmm. I guess the target is that the goal is to get the right people to move.
That's right.
So Sarah Schulman, author, activist, a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, a Guggenheim Fellow, and one of 18, or no, you weren't one of 18 to change yourself to the fence, but you were there. Right. Thank you for joining us this morning on What's at Stake.
Thank you so much.
Up next, he fought fiercely in World War II, swearing to join the hunt for Adolf Hitler. By the end of his life, Philip Berrigan had been nominated not once but twice for the Nobel Peace Prize. Brad Wolf, the editor, author of A Ministry of Risk, Writings on Peace and Nonviolence, joins us in the studio. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
Born of Haitian descent, Jerry Paris, WPFW's general manager, is moving on to retirement. On April 14th, from 3 p.m. until 7 p.m., we will celebrate his departure at the VIP Room, 6201 3rd Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., with island flair, steel drums, a DJ, and food from the islands. That's April 14th, from 3 p.m. until 7 p.m. For more information and tickets, call 202-368-4081 or visit Eventbrite and search for Jerry Paris Retirement. Seating is limited.
And welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, Brad Wolf, Philip Berrigan evolved from a... Brad Wolf, welcome to What's at Stake this morning. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. Good morning.
So now, Philip Berrigan evolved from a young man thirsty to join his brothers in combat in World War II, stating that he wanted to join the hunt for Adolf Hitler to hack him in pieces and count the demons as they flew out of his wounds, to a man arrested over 100 times, in prison for a total of 11 years, including solitary confinement, enduring fasts and hunger strikes, and all for the sake of bringing peace to America and the world. Clearly something impacted the trajectory of his life, and I want to hear about that. But first, let's start at the beginning. Introduce us to 18-year-old Philip.
Well, Philip Berrigan was born in Two Harbors, Minnesota, and he's a Depression-era baby, one of six boys, and grew up in a Catholic family with a socialist father and a mother who was Catholic and read the Catholic Worker to her sons each day. And though they were desperately poor, they were constantly sharing their meals with individuals who would come knocking on their door desperate for food. And so as Phil grew into a man and reached this 18-year-old man that you referenced, he had a sensitivity and an understanding for those who were suffering and those who were in need. And yet it was also mixed with this patriotism, this desire to go to war, to be a war hero, because that's part of the culture of militarism that is the United States. He was raised with this idea, and his older brothers had gone to World War II. So he was anxious to go. But the one brother who did not go was his brother Daniel Berrigan. Daniel joined the Jesuits during the war, and Phil was wondering whether he too should join the seminary or should he go to war. He made the decision to go to war, and he thought that he could contribute best by trying to attack the Nazis, and as you made that quote, hack the demons out of Adolf Hitler as they came out of his body. But he soon realized, once he was over there and saw the devastation and the horrors that were World War II, that he was becoming much like the Nazis, and that the Americans were becoming much like the Nazis. So the fascinating part about Phil is the evolution that he underwent during his lifetime. So he did evolve from this Philip the Bold, as he calls himself, to Philip the Peacemaker.
So Stokely Carmichael is quoted in your book as having said, quote, "Phil is the only white guy who knows where it's at." That's pretty high praise coming from a black nationalist in the 1960s who's coined the phrase black power. How did Berrigan interact with the civil rights movement at that time that earned him that unique recognition by Stokely Carmichael?
That's a fascinating part of Phil's story. When I was conducting the research for this book in the archives at Cornell and DePaul, there were so many writings by Phil about race, segregation, and the connection of segregation and war. And when Phil was in World War II, what he saw firsthand was the intense discrimination of African Americans down south when he was in training camp. And he continued to witness the discrimination and the horrible treatment of African Americans while in the service during World War II. So when he returned home, he did decide to join the seminary and become a Catholic priest. And he chose the Josephite Order of the Catholic Church, which is a Catholic order dedicated to serving African Americans. And so in the mid-1950s, he began working in African American communities. He became a civil rights activist. He organized for the poor against the tenement housing that was so bad at the time. All of this was done that continually angered his superiors in the Catholic order. So they were transferring him from one city to another to try to silence him from speaking out on civil rights. But he continued to engage and to be an active participant in the civil rights movement.
So I'm wondering, was he among the ministers who accompanied the young then activist John Lewis on Bloody Sunday across the Edmund Pettus Bridge?
He was at the March on Washington. He was at Selma. He did the Freedom Bus Rides. He tried to go into Jackson, Mississippi to integrate that city. His diocesan superior called him at the airport shortly before he was to enter and ordered him back. Phil complied with that order, one of the few times he would comply with his diocesan order to return, but he was very active in the civil rights movement, and his first book that was published in 1965 was called No More Strangers, and that was about race relations, segregation, and the treatment of African Americans in the United States.
So during a stint in prison, he came across Black Panther leader Eldridge Cleaver's autobiography, Soul on Ice, and was reportedly moved by it. What did he take away from Cleaver's book?
You know, that was right after Phil had committed the action known as the Baltimore Four, where Phil and three others in October of 1967 went into the Selective Service Office in Baltimore, and they poured their blood on draft file records in order to both destroy the records so young men would not be drafted, but also to symbolize the spilt blood in Vietnam. He received a six-year prison sentence for that, and it was during that prison sentence that Phil read Soul on Ice. And he read it at a time when he said he was in the doldrums, he was feeling bad about himself, prison life was really wearing him down. And he thanked Cleaver in this book for lifting his spirit, for liberating him, because he saw in Cleaver someone else who had gone to prison. He saw in Cleaver someone else who had evolved and found their humanity through suffering. And so he felt that Cleaver's idea of going to prison and discovering an identity through reading and writing while in prison was an important facet of this process. And so Phil did the same. And he wrote to his brother, Daniel Berrigan, about this book and saying, "I owe great thanks to Soul on Ice for having liberated me during the doldrums of prison."
And actually, when he was awaiting sentencing for that Baltimore 4 action, he jumped bail and became a wanted felon for a while.
He did. It's a fascinating story. So he commits the action in Baltimore in 67. He's awaiting sentencing. He knows he's going to go to prison for a long time for doing that. So he quickly organizes another action in Catonsville, Maryland in May of 68, where they hit another selective service office and they take hundreds of draft file records and they pour homemade napalm on them, destroying them. Then he is to report to prison for his sentence for the Baltimore action. He decides to go underground along with his brother, Daniel. And they become fugitives from justice. So Phil evolves from World War II veteran to Catholic priest to peace activist to political prisoner to felon to fugitive. And he's one of the FBI's most sought after fugitives at the time. J. Edgar Hoover was beside himself trying to track down these Catholic priests.
So it was written that Phil really sort of basically created a new type of resistance in the anti-war movement when he and the three others known as the Baltimore Four raided the local draft board office. Was that, what kind of resistance was that? The pouring of the blood on the draft records? Is that what it was?
You know, when you think about that action, I'm amazed at the creativity of it, because nonviolent resistance takes many forms. And Phil thought deeply about what form his nonviolent resistance would take. So they decided to choose a selective service office. They decided to choose draft records, which Phil referred to as human hunting licenses. They then decided to pour blood on the draft records, which was, again, the spilt blood in Vietnam, but also the blood of Christ, certainly a Christian metaphor that they were using. Then the decision to use homemade napalm to burn the files. So all of these were very symbolic, powerful messages. But the resistance effort itself in that, the destroying of those files, is unique because at the time, there were no duplicates of those files and they were not computerized. So when they destroyed those draft files, they were literally saving young men from being conscripted to kill or be killed in Vietnam. And after Phil did this, others started hitting selective service offices across the country, and hundreds of service offices were hit from 1967 to 1972, and hundreds of thousands of draft file records were destroyed. So that was the new form of resistance that was created. Destroy the draft records, stop the people from being sent to Vietnam.
It was very creative, and I wonder if they knew that it would have that sort of a widespread impact. And the effect that it was having, saving individuals from having to go to that war.
They did not know that they were the only copies kept until the trial. That was revealed at the trial of the Baltimore Four by the prosecution. And when they heard that, you know, a little bell went off and they thought, oh, that's an interesting benefit that we had not anticipated. What Phil was after in doing those actions was he wanted to stir dinner conversation around American tables every evening. Why are these Catholic priests in prison? Why are they pouring blood on draft files? He wanted to stimulate conversation among middle-class America to get people engaged in this rather than turning off to the war and going about their business.
And so it was the Cuban Missile Crisis, actually, that linked Phil's civil rights work with his burgeoning anti-war activism. Can connect the dots for us in that, would you, Brad?
Yeah, Phil was down in New Orleans in 1962. He had been moved down there by his order, again, to try to silence him. And when he was down there during the Cuban Missile Crisis, what he recognized was that the wealthy upper middle class whites were able to flee New Orleans, which was in the zone of targets if the Cuban missiles would be fired on the United States. So they were able to flee the area, but the African Americans there were not. And so he began to see that all of the money that's being spent on armaments, on nuclear weapons, on the upcoming war in Vietnam was having this devastating effect on people at home, on the United States. And so the dots that he was connecting was that as we oppress a large part of our population at home, the African-American community, it becomes easier for us to try to oppress people in foreign lands, to impose our will and our ideas and our ideology on people in foreign lands. And if we demonize people here at home, then it's easier to demonize Russians and others. And so he saw them very much as connected, both in terms of money spent, but also in terms of our morality or the loss of our morality.
And so moving on, there's a phrase, to beat swords into plowshares, which is basically, I believe, a concept that means to convert military weapons or technology for peaceful or civilian applications. Now, Phil Berrigan and seven fellow activists known as the Plowshares 8 broke into a General Electric nuclear missile facility in Pennsylvania. What was their objective there, Brad, and what was the outcome?
So the beating swords into plowshares is from the prophet Isaiah, to beat swords into plowshares and study war no more. So the idea was they were going to go into the General Electric nuclear facility in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania in 1980 and hammer on the nose cones of missiles and symbolically beat the missiles into plowshares to disarm them. They did so. They also poured blood on blueprints for weapons inside. And this was in 1980, so this was many years after his involvement in the anti-war efforts of Vietnam. And it's indicative of Phil that he continues his efforts all the way up until the day he dies in 2002. He did not give up. But when they go into King of Prussia, again, this was a major breach of security. A trial occurred afterwards. The appeal process lasted some 10 years. But again, the interesting thing about that movement, that plowshares movement, was that it spurred so many other plowshares movements that continue to this day. So there have been over 70 plowshares movements occurring in countries all over the world, people breaking into nuclear facilities or military bases, pouring the blood on the missiles, the nose cones, things of that nature, trying to demonstrate the need to study war no more, to take the, to sort of push back the culture of death with the truth of humanity.
Mm-hmm. I know it's symbolic, but you're pouring the blood on the nose cones. That really, can they just wash the blood off and use those weapons anyway? Okay. Yes,
they can. But actually, when they hammered on the nose cones, they did dent the nose cones. And in different plowshares actions that Phil engaged in over the years, there were results of actually dismantling some of the weapons involved. So it had more than symbolic effect.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the hammering on the nose. Yeah. So
exactly.
Phil decided to become a Catholic minister. And you said that that's when he joined the Josephite order?
Correct. Okay. Yes.
And expound on that. What is that Josephite order? You said it's designed to deal with the issues of African
American. Yeah, it's a Catholic order that's designed to serve the African American community. And so Phil joined that. He returned from World War II. He was sort of lost, disillusioned. As he writes, he looked into the mirror of his own violence and saw what he had done and what he had witnessed in World War II. And he was looking around. He relied on his Catholic faith and on his brother Daniel's example, and so joined the Josephites because he wanted to serve in the African-American community. And he anticipated doing that for the rest of his life, not recognizing that the war in Vietnam would heat up to such a degree and that this connection between civil rights and militarism would become so obvious to him that he would have to take action.
But I was going to say,
I think what Phil teaches us is, you know, how to become fully human, how to embrace and engage all those elements of our humanity, our courage, our compassion, our grace, and our soul and our imagination. It's very easy to turn a blind eye and to be diverted from systemic racism or militarism or things of that nature, you know, income inequality or even the environment. That's what the state wants us to do. But Phil, I think, teaches us how to avoid that, because if you do that, if you don't engage those parts, you're going to lose your humanity. And so Phil's teaching us, again, to be fully human.
How do you think he'd respond to what's going on in Gaza?
Yeah, I think he would be appalled, and I think he would be angered, and I think he would move to action. Phil's words repeatedly to people over the decades were, don't get tired, right? Don't get tired. You have to keep at it. And so you push back the darkness with the truth. You live the truth, you act the truth, you bear witness to the truth. And try not to get too wrapped up in the actual results. Just live out the actions and do what you have to do. I named this book A Ministry of Risk because it's taken from a homily he gave in 1974, where he was speaking at the ordination of another priest, and he wanted to convey to that priest that you have to take risk as a priest and as an individual, as a layperson in life, if you are going to be fully human. And so I think he would tell us all to take risks. And as your previous guest, as Sarah was indicating, people are taking risk every day in the war on Gaza. They're going out, they're risking arrest, they're making statements, they're signing letters, they're doing whatever they have to do. Phil recognized that the war in Gaza is a continuation of the culture of militarism in the United States, that it has to be confronted and challenged.
Well, you know, even though he joined the Catholic Church, as a minister, he noted in 1965, quote, the church has been particularly impotent in the face of war, whether the conventional type or the present nuclear impasse, because it has always been against war in general, but never in particular. What did he mean? And would he that situation to be any different today?
Yeah, Phil was a pretty strident critic of the Catholic Church, and he felt that he was entitled to do so since he was a Catholic priest. He was within the church itself. He had been raised within it. And the American Catholic Church has, for the most part, supported every war that we've been engaged in. They did it in the early part of the 20th century in order to prove their allegiance to the United States as new immigrants. But that became less and less important, and certainly to someone like Phil, He thought the church deserved a place, not with the empire, not with the state, not with war, but with the victims. And so he was very critical of the church, saying, yeah, they'll stand in the pulpit every Sunday and say, let us have peace. But they will never be specific in criticizing a particular action of the United States, never be specific in criticizing a particular war of the United States. So when you ask for peace generally, it really becomes a meaningless statement. Phil wanted people in the church, the bishops, the priests, and the parishioners to be out voicing their opinion about war and taking the risks that he took and that everybody else would take.
So he was critical of the church, and the church was critical of him too. He and his wife, Elizabeth McAllister, who was a former Catholic nun, were excommunicated, of course, assume when they got married. Were they troubled by that? I mean, it seemed as though they had blown away from the teachings and practices of the Catholic Church.
There were certain dogmas of the church with which they disagreed. And as you indicated, Elizabeth McAllister was a Catholic nun, and she and Phil had met in the 1960s. They were working together in the anti-war movement. In 1969, they privately exchanged vows in a church, just the two of them, marriage vows. And they didn't tell anybody. And of course, this is not allowed in the Catholic Church. And once it was revealed in 1971, they were excommunicated from the church. They then married and they started Jonah House, which was a Catholic worker type house in Baltimore, where they raised a family and they had people coming in and living with them and teaching about nonviolent resistance and living a community-oriented life, an intentional community life there. But, you know, their belief was that celibacy in the church should be optional for priests and for nuns. And they were trying to push that forward as yet another element of their resistance. They felt that their marriage was a radical example of their emphasis on love and on peace and on trying to demonstrate how the church needed to change with the times in certain aspects.
And they had three children?
They did. Three wonderful children. They had Frida, Jerry, and Kate, and all of whom are activists. And Frida's a wonderful writer in her own right. And they grew up in a very interesting family dynamic with parents who were in and out of prison for nonviolent resistance, and yet living in this community environment at Jonah House with everybody kind of tipping in and working together to build a family environment.
And so in a letter to the Los Angeles News Advocate in 1971, Berrigan writes, quote, "In a word, I believe in revolution, and I hope to continue making a nonviolent contribution to it. In my view, we are not going to save this country and mankind without it. And I am centrally concerned with the gospel view that the massive suffering of this war and American imperialism around the world will be confronted only by people who are willing to go with suffering as the first move to justice." Of course, he was talking about the Vietnam War. So they talk about revolution as a nonviolent revolution. Some would say that's an oxymoron. But how did Berrigan define his position, and how did he execute a nonviolent revolution? How did that manifest, Brad?
You know, that was such an interesting part of the research that I, when I was doing this over the last 3 years, the three words that Phil seemed to use more than any other in his writings were resistance, revolution, and liberation. And I began to see them as a journey that Phil was taking, that he was embracing nonviolent resistance. And once he fully embraced nonviolent resistance, he saw that revolution was the obvious next step. Nonviolent revolution, that would be a revolution of the soul, a revolution of the mind, but also a revolution of society, a rebuilding of society. He did not think American society could be reformed. It was going to have to be rebuilt. And once you embraced resistance and revolution, you then were going to arrive at liberation. You were going to be truly a liberated soul. So nonviolent revolution is entirely possible. We've seen nonviolent revolutions across the country. Many of the former Soviet bloc countries overthrew the governments through nonviolence. Certainly the end of segregation in the South was achieved through nonviolence. The end of the Vietnam War, for the most part, was achieved through nonviolence. So revolution, you know, I came away realizing that Fool was a full-on revolutionary, but a nonviolent revolutionary.
Okay. And so he was arrested over 100 times, imprisoned for a total of 11 years, including solitary confinement. He endured hunger fast and hunger strikes. His commitment and sacrifices captured the attention of the world. He was nominated not once but twice for the Nobel Peace Prize. But were his actions too controversial for him to actually win, do you think?
Depends on how you would define win. I think, again, Phil sets an example. It's not one that all of us must follow. I don't think Phil would say you all must follow my identical pattern or journey. But you all should, as he said, go into the breach with the victims, because until we go into the breach with the victims, the victimization will not stop. And that can take many forms for us. So we all have to engage in our own ministry of risk and decide with our own conscience, what acts are we going to take for the brothers and sisters we have across the globe? So yes, Phil's acts were controversial. People disagreed with them. But in a large degree, that was the point. He wanted to engage people in discussion. He wanted to raise the awareness of these issues because they were being swept under the rug intentionally by the military-industrial complex. And if he did these, what many people thought were outrageous actions, you couldn't sweep them under the rug. And this would be a part of his resistance. They would have to be talked about.
Prick the consciousness, so to speak.
Exactly.
And so, Brad, you write that while editing this book, the process you used had an impact on you that you had not expected. Tell us a little bit about the process in the couple of minutes we have left and the impact that it had on you.
Sure. When I went to the archives at DePaul University in Cornell, there were hundreds of boxes of the Berrigan documents. That's where the Berrigan papers were kept. And as I came across all these pages of documents, the only way I knew how to do it, because this is the first book that I've edited, the only way I knew how to do it was to take pictures with my iPhone of every page of the documents that I thought were relevant. So I would return home from these universities with hundreds and hundreds of photographs of documents. And then I would dictate them out loud into my laptop, and I could then begin editing them, moving them around, arranging them chronologically in the manner that I thought was appropriate. But the process of dictating them out loud had an impact on me that I had not anticipated, because saying Phil's words out loud challenged me and convicted me in a way that I had not thought was going to happen. I would often stop after reciting something and have to think about what I had just said. Because when you say somebody else's words out loud, you take a certain ownership in them because you've just repeated them out loud. And it causes you to stop and question yourself and think, would I do that? Am I brave enough to do that? Do I agree with that? How does that challenge me? And how does that change me? And it didn't change me. There's no doubt that the 3 years of working on this and writing this and editing this changed my life and my thinking in a profound way. So I would encourage readers who may buy this book, read some of the sections out loud and see if it's not different to you as a reader when you read some of Phil's words out loud as opposed to simply reading them silently.
Thank you, author, editor Brad Wolf. The name of the book, A Ministry of Risk, Writings on Peace and Nonviolence, Philip Berrigan. Brad, thank you for being our guest this morning on What's at Stake.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of What's at Stake. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Kalia. Next week, Denise Young will be in the host seat. I'm Verna Avery Brown, and in the words of the late Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done. Up next, Wake Up and Stay Woke with Dr. E. Trey Williams.
WPFW must move by December 2024 and will be hosting a series of events and presenting special programming to raise the funds necessary for our new home. We kick off these efforts Saturday through Sunday, April 6th and 7th, with Jazz is the Teacher, Funk is the Preacher, 2 days of programming dedicated to the jazz and funk idioms. From the searing riffs of the J.B. Horns to Les McCann's soulful piano comping, to the Art Ensemble of Chicago's funk-drenched composition themed to Yo-Yo, jazz and funk have always been intertwined. We're hoping that the music inspires you to support this effort by visiting WPFWFM.org to make a tax-deductible secure donation to our relocation fund. That's Jazz is the Teacher, Funk is the Preacher, Saturday and Sunday, April 6th and 7th, from midnight to midnight. WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
Greetings, family. The WPFW Programmers Association, in harmony with station management, presents WPFW Live, a series of events over the next 6 months in partnership with some of your favorite local venues. The goal is to re-engage the community through a remembering of the valued relationships forged, all pointing to a reimagination of our future. Our first WPFW Live event will be held Wednesday, April 3rd, 5 to 9 p.m. at 18th Street Lounge, 1230 9th Street Northwest. meet some of your favorite local programmers, enjoy great music, and partake in good spirits. Music by DJ Rahsaan, Music Relief Radio, Kamal Harris, Beats, Bars, and Bangers, and featuring DJ Divine, Soulful House Sessions. Food by Chef Jarobi of Flavorful Influences. Tickets are $20 and available at Eventbrite by searching WPFW Live. For details, call 202-618-2110. WPFW, changing the world one.